on today's Run to the Top podcast.
Staying on top of the daily needs of athletes is really important. And for someone that's self-coached, just being honest with yourself. We are adults. Most of the people I work with are over 24, 25. They have jobs and things like that. So staying on top of your particular life and not being a slave to your training plan is probably the first recommendation I would make.
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Stephanie K. Atwood.
Welcome. This is Stephanie K. Atwood, Boston Marathon qualifier, coach, and host for the Run to the Top podcast. On today's Run to the Top podcast, we will talk with Peyton Hoyle of Running to Win about how to stay on top of your game. It's a struggle to get there and often even more of a challenge to stay where you want to be with your running. Peyton will share some of coaching tips on how he brings his clients to their best and helps them stay there. We'll also talk about the importance of a community of runners to support you. Whether it's an actual team, a few good buddies, or a running club, we'll discuss the benefits of having other runners for support, accountability, and motivation. Welcome, Peyton.
Hey, Stephanie. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the interview. Let me read a little bit about you, because I've got a nice little bio here. Peyton Hoyle was a track and field All-American in the marathon, an event quite unique to collegiate racing. After graduation, he worked as a high school classroom teacher and distance running coach. Training at moderate altitude, he set all of his current personal bests while working full-time. At the same time as he was setting his own PRs, he began to develop an equal passion for helping others achieve their goals in the sport of running. Since 2011, Peyton has helped runners from youth to master's level perform at their best when it counts in their racing endeavors. He has guided a Foot Locker cross-country finalist, a Pan Am Games qualifier, a multi-time U.S. track and field master's champion, and many others during his time as a coach. He served as an adult running coach for Zap Fitness and has written extensively on the sport via such outlets as RunningShoesGuru.com, the Atlanta Track Club, and Endurance Magazine. Thank you for being here to discuss running with us, Peyton.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, well, let's start with the four basics. How old are you now?
I am 29.
Where were you born?
I was born in Thomaston, Georgia.
Wow. Where do you live now?
Live in Charlottesville, Virginia, about 2 hours south of D.C.
And what is your current favorite running distance?
Ooh, I'd have to say the half marathon. It's always been pretty alluring to me.
Yeah, it's a good one. I think the majority of the people I interview who are runners, and most of them are, prefer the half marathon, at least a good proportion of them.
Yeah, it doesn't take quite as much out of you as the marathon, but you can still incorporate all the fun elements of training that you tend to neglect when you're in the heart of marathon training.
I agree. So talking about being an accomplished runner, you definitely have accomplished quite a bit on your own. So tell us a bit about some of your best races and when you started running.
Yeah. Well, I started running probably ninth grade or so. I played football and was an ROTC when I was in high school. We didn't have much of a running infrastructure where I grew up. Thomaston's about 3 hours south of Atlanta. It's, you know, very, very rural. Football and basketball were really our two main sports. So I actually played football until my sophomore year of high school. Started running just for fun and fitness. My mom would actually drop me off starting at about a half mile from home, and I would run home and my football pads in cleats, actually. And we extended that out to about 3 miles. Uh-huh. And my dad was like, son, you probably don't need to be running in football cleats. We should get you some running shoes. And that's kind of when my running took off. Uh-huh. But I was not very good in high school. My mile PR was like 4:53. I ran 10:25 for the 2 mile. Did better in cross country. I was just under 17 minutes. And in Georgia, the courses were very rough. They were, you know, a little bit hilly, a little bit muddy, always pretty hot. So, I mean, that was probably worth a little bit more. But I was very lucky to even be asked to run for a college team with times like that. But as I got older, I matured a little bit, really focused on the training, because I knew I didn't have the raw talent to be very good. And that kind of that brought me to where I am today, basically.
All right. And give us some examples of some of your good races. I know you've got some great times in there.
Yeah, I'd say when I was in college, I had a really good coach. We had a really tight team unit at Berry College in Rome, Georgia. It was an NAIA school, like you had mentioned in my bio. We had the marathon option in track season, which was very, very intriguing to me. So my coach kind of helped me gear most of my training to that. I was running 90 to 100 miles a week by my sophomore year in college, which was more than a lot of the guys on my team. I was really big into the ancillary stuff, doing stuff in the gym, trying to get as strong as I could in the right muscles, knowing how young I was and what I was asking my body to do with the marathon.
Yeah.
And my first marathon was in 2009 at Track Nationals. It was in St. Louis on a very hilly course. It was like a 75 degree day. And at about mile 16, a bunch of guys that were way faster than me started to drop out of the race. Mm-hmm. And before I knew it, I was in about 10th. And at about 22 miles, I saw my coach on the course. He threw me a gel and was jumping up and down telling me, hey, if you go now, you can be top five and top six was all American. And I ended up coming in fifth, ran 2:34 in my first marathon. So it was a lot of fun.
Wow. Sounds like it. What about the half marathon? Since you said that was your favorite, what was your best time in half marathon?
The half was something I used when I was coaching. It's just kind of a parameter of fitness. Like a lot of people, they'll use their 10K time to kind of base their training. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of really good competitive half marathons in North Carolina where I used to live. Especially in the Asheville area, Raleigh, the Research Triangle. And when I was teaching, it was, I would race about twice a month just to supplement my income with prize money. I mean, it was $300 here, $500 there, but it definitely helped. Living in Blowing Rock, which is kind of a resort area, it was pretty expensive. So started to kind of understand that motivation that I think a lot of our African athletes have where, hey, if I don't do well in this race, I'm going to be out of my grocery money for the month.
Yeah.
It was just kind of tight. So that was a little bit of extra motivation. For the half in 2013 and 2014, I think I raced probably 15 or 16 halves those 2 years. And really every race, it got better and better and better, provided it wasn't bad weather or an odd course. And then in 2015, in a pretty small race, but it's a great course. It's super well organized. It's the St. Michael's Run Fest half marathon. Michael Wardian, the ultra runner, and I got asked to participate in this race. We stayed at a host house for the night, and I got there that morning. It was about 82 degrees and I had on my singlet and everything. I was like, man, it is hot. And I remember just dripping sweat, warming up. And I tossed my singlet in the car, put my bib on my shorts, got out there and I ran a 108.13 in that race, which was faster than my high school 2 mile PR.
Wow. Good for you.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. You must be good in the heat.
Well, growing up in Georgia, I think my pores, they became accustomed to dilating a certain way, and it didn't seem that hot to me that day.
Yeah. Oh, good for you. Well, so obviously coaching is important to you as well as your own running. And what made you decide to get into it? And tell us about what kind of certifications you have for coaching.
Sure. I had a USATF level 3 certification for a while, but it was something that I just let expire because of work and busy. I was certified in North Carolina, obviously through the High School Association, but I honestly found that with those certifications, they tended to limit coaches on their creativity.
Interesting.
You have all this physiology that's kind of thrown at you and things that tend to work in the lab and in these controlled settings. But when you're dealing with 90 high school kids with hormones and busy lives and tests and things, a lot of that kind of goes out the window and you just need to use your intuition more. So I never really made an effort to renew those certifications or advance them. I've attended the Distance Running Summit before, and I like to get a lot of my information firsthand from coaches that I trust, like Pete Ray with Zap, my college coach. I'm lucky in Charlotte. Mark Lawrence with Ragged Mountain Run Club. He's a grower. And then just reading everything I could get my hands on. So I mean, even when I was in high school, just starting out, I was as fascinated with the training theory as I was the races at that particular point, because I just saw that they were so congruent. And with somebody with minimal talent or, very basic talent, I said, well, if I didn't win this lottery, maybe I can train myself into shape to run the times that I want to run and then be able to help other people do that too.
Yeah, I think that's a really fine point, and it's a good one to bring up, that there is so much that you can accomplish through just dedication, training, and I truly think good coaching is a very important part of being able to find out how good you can be.
Sure. And, you know, kind of, you know, sometimes you have to walk that line and sometimes you have to go over that line to find out where your boundary is at that particular point. I hate to call it a breaking point, but I think we've all had that, you know, in their career where we pushed a little too hard. And then, you know, 6 months later, we pushed to that same level and, you know, you kind of wait for the piano to fall on your head and it doesn't. And then you end up racing really well. It just takes a little bit of time sometimes.
Yeah. So, moving on to our subject of today, to really be staying at the top of our game, there a lot of the interviews we have here on Run to the Top are geared to a more beginning or intermediate level. But I'd like to go over with you about already being a pretty good competitor and then wanting to better that or at least to stay at that level. I know personally, I mean, it can just be tough. So what are some of your ideas to make this a reality?
Sure. And I think that's, you know, that's that point in an adult person's running career, you know, whether they ran in high school, in college, competed post-collegiately, whatever it might be, where we do kind of hit those plateaus. And, you know, what might have been a 3-month plateau when we were 18 becomes a 6-month plateau when we're 22. And then, you know, as adults, they can sometimes, you start to wonder, am I ever doing a PR again, or am I ever going to get back to this particular level? Mm-hmm. And I equate it, you know, usually something that I think we can kind of equate to is someone who is dieting to lose weight. You know, you reduce your calories to 2,000 a day and you have a sensible exercise regimen and things like that. And, you know, you lose 10 pounds, you lose 15 pounds. Well, at some point you kind of stagnate and you stop losing that weight and you have to manipulate your diet or your exercise routine to further that growth. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same thing with running. You know, you get to that point where you're comfortable with your 70 miles a week or 80 or whatever is your comfortable ceiling. You don't really push beyond that because you're busy with work, you're busy with life, you have kids, you get married, that kind of thing. And we forget that, you know, inside that volume and that time that we're able to commit to running, there's so many other variables that we can manipulate to keep that stimulus fresh and keep you adapting towards whatever your goal may be.
Yeah. And you said that there, you have some sort of innovative methods of training that you have tried on at least some of your clients. So can you talk about some of those?
Sure. And I mean, everything I do, I mean, I work right now I work full time as a running shoe territory manager for On Running, the Swiss company. So I am busy. I do travel a lot. And right now my client load, I can handle 10 to 15 clients or so and still give them adequate time. You know, I spend a lot of time on the road. So that's usually when I'll call my coaching clients, just check in, you know, try to talk to everybody, you know, at least every 10 days or so on the phone, you know, set up time. Sometimes if I know somebody's free that day, I'll just give them a call and really stay on top of, you know, what is happening in this 10 to 12 day adaptation window? What is going on in your particular life right now, today, and how we can move the training around that so that the training plan isn't something that is hard and fast. It's definitely written in pencil, and it's something that we can modify on the fly. You know, if somebody's kid gets sick or if they have a calf problem that's been kind of recurrent, I try to only write training for, you know, 5 to 15 day blocks at a time, where it's like, this is really concrete. In these next 5 days, let's try to hit these two things, and everything else, you know, just kind of revolves around your life. So staying on top of the daily needs of athletes, I think, is really important. And for someone that's self-coached, just being honest with yourself. You know, we are adults, you know, at this point in the game, most of the people I work with, I mean, are over 24, 25, they have jobs and things like that. So staying on top of your particular life and not being a slave to your training plan is probably the first recommendation I would make. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, I mean, there are certain scientific, very research supported methods, you know, to advance, you know, different physiological elements. I kind of shy away a little bit from the traditional terminology like VO2 max, lactate threshold, things like that, in favor more of, you know, things that aren't quite as tangible from a physiological perspective, but they are very important in terms of race pace. So when I sit down to talk to an athlete for that very first time, we discuss their goals. Let's say they want to run a 10K at 6-minute pace. So that's the mathematical goal. You know, we know what that's supposed to look like.
Right.
And we need to spend some time at 70% of race pace, which is, you know, a good bit slower, and then 80 and then 90 and then 100 and then maybe up to 110. So we don't create these huge gaps in fitness. One thing I think with adults, when they don't have a coach that's there working with them on a daily basis, is they read a book. They might read Daniel's running formula, which is very neat. You know, we kind of move through a repetition pace, which is like mile race pace, to an interval pace, which is like 5K race pace. well, that's kind of a gap there between 1 mile or 800 pace to 5K pace. Mm-hmm. And then we move all the way up to half marathon pace, you know, somewhere mm-hmm. around our lactate threshold.
Right.
Well, most adults are racing between the 5K, 10K, 15K, up to the half marathon. If we don't spend any time, you know, closing those gaps a little bit physiologically, I think that's one of the key things that we miss in American training and Western training is we don't address, you know, I need to do a tempo run at 90% of race pace. That may be faster than lactate threshold. It may be slower than lactate threshold, but we need to be able to do that. So then we can cover the distance at our appropriate pace. And that's usually the first thing that I manipulate is I look at gaps in the training and I don't usually change what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I look at what they're not doing. So maybe mm-hmm. they're not doing any core work or any stuff in the gym. Well, if we mm-hmm. add that, that's a new stimulus and that's going to spur adaptation. Maybe they live in a flat area and they're not getting any of the resistance benefits from hills. Well, we need to find some way to simulate that, be it on a treadmill or up an overpass or some way to kind of add something new into the training. Maybe right. their longest run in the last 3 years and they're training for a half marathon is only 15 miles. Uh-huh. What happens if we push that to 18? You know, and we do it once and we mm-hmm. kind of cautiously see what happened. And then we do it again a little bit more deliberately once we get that confidence back. But it's really, I mean, to me, you know, and this is all something that Renato Canova has spoken about quite a bit. It's not what we are doing in training that's the problem. It's what we're avoiding or what we're not doing in training.
Yeah, yeah. And the adaptations, as you said. So that's, you know, a lot of times it is adding something like strength training, core work, things that aren't even specifically running.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, if we can, you know, list a ton of examples like Matt Elliott a few years ago, he was somebody that I followed when I was teaching because he was a classroom teacher and he came in third at USA's in the 1500 going into the world championships. And he had this really emotional interview afterward and people really fell in love with him. But he talks about working with Scott Simmons, who is a loose acquaintance of mine. I actually went to his running camp twice when I was in high school. And he was one of the coaches that I really followed and kind of became fascinated with because he was good at taking these kind of B-level athletes and really converting them into national class and world class runners.
Nice.
And he's done so well with the Army team and the American Distance Project. He was somebody that I really respected as a coach mm-hmm. For a long time. But one thing that he used to talk about was, you know, being able to manipulate and add different variables and how do we address this overload and things. And he was coaching Matt when he came in third in the 1500.
Nice.
And one of the things he added with Matt was simply, we need to put some weight on your body and get you stronger. So mm-hmm. he sent him to the weight room 2 days a week, which Matt mm-hmm. had never done before uh-huh. Because he was kind of a muscular guy anyway. He was like, I don't need to bulk up or add this weight.
Right.
Well, he started squatting heavy and got his bench press up and started doing some deadlifts. And I mean, he went from a B-level athlete to an A-level athlete in a couple of months.
Wow. So, you know, obviously serious runners are interested in maybe even going faster than they already are going. So what does that look like for you? What are some examples of some of the people that you've coached who you've actually moved into a faster level just from the kind of coaching and training that you've offered them?
Yeah, I think one of my more prominent athletes that I've coached that was kind of a Cinderella story. His name is Frankie Adkins. He would not mind me bringing him up, I don't think, in this podcast and talking about his training a little bit. He lives in Asheville, North Carolina. He's a great guy. He's got two kids at home. He worked full time when I was coaching him as a pharmaceutical sales rep. So he was on the road. You know, he was just out there, you know, visiting his accounts on a daily basis. Sometimes he'd get his runs in at 5 a.m. Sometimes it was 8 p.m.
Yeah.
You know, he was one of those guys that pretty much did it all. He had a really good social circle at home. He had a Thursday night poker night in his basement. So he was really doing everything. He was a complete person.
Well,
and that's usually what I look like when I'm, you know, picking up a new coaching client is this person a complete person? Are they in it? You know, I mean, are they full of life, that kind of thing. And are they enthusiastic about their running ultimately?
Right.
But with Frankie, he was stuck in, and this is something I find a lot with most people that are over 30. He was 39 when I started coaching him.
Okay.
He had not really improved too much through his 30s. He ran in college. He had 10K PR, I think right around 33 minutes on the road. And he had, you know, a decent 5K PR, but he had never really run a competitive half marathon or a full marathon. And as he neared that master's ranks, he wanted to get good. And
yeah.
he called me because a couple of my friends had recommended that he reach out to me because they knew that I coached. And he said, Peyton, he said, look, I'm going to be 40 in October. And I think this was maybe July of 2012 or 2013. And he said, I have these very tangible goals for when I turn 40. Do you think you can help me achieve them. We met, went for a run, and I just listened to him talk. I wanted to hear everything that he wanted to do with his running. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I pitched in, you know, a few ideas here, a few ideas there. Well, right. The next thing I know, he had hired me full-time as his running coach. And we were able to really investigate what he was doing on a weekly basis, microcycle, and then on a larger scale, the macrocycle of his full season. And what I saw was a lot of consistency, but not a lot of stimulus. So There was a group that met for a Tuesday night track workout. He went to that religiously. Mm-hmm. There was a group that met for a Thursday kind of extended tempo run. It was kind of in that vague, you know, we start about 7 minute pace and we get down to 6 minute pace, depending on how we feel, but it didn't have that real intent. And then he did something shorter and faster on Saturday or a race. And then he was part of the Church of the Sunday Long Run on Sunday with a bunch of guys in Asheville. And this had gone on for years. So when I looked at his training, everything was there necessarily, but I just did not think that he was getting the right doses of certain things and the right amounts of others and maybe neglecting some things that I thought we could stick in. So instead of having this 4 hard day a week schedule that he had been following for so long, I said, hey, I said, let's take a step back. I said, let's go to 2 workouts a week, but these are going to be extremely intentional and focused workouts. Mm-hmm. And I put him basically on a Wednesday, Saturday workout routine where every other Saturday essentially became a workout unto itself, even though that was the long run day. And I said, let's play with this, because this way we can sneak in some faster aerobic runs, because I found that he was doing his easy runs maybe a little bit too slow on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I said, that'll be a good stimulus. Let's get into that moderate zone a little bit, which for him was, you know, between about 6:15 and 5:50 pace. I said, we hadn't really spent much time here. Let's actually address this zone. So we could fill that in. We start adding in some very short, very fast sprints uphill, just from a neuromuscular perspective. I knew he was getting a little bit older. We didn't want to, you know, lose the speed that he had left in his legs. Right. And the quickest, easiest way to address that is by getting the central nervous system firing. You don't have to go to the track and run 12 by 400. I don't really consider that speed work. What I do consider speed work is running 12 seconds as fast as you can up a steep hill and then recovering for 2 minutes. Uh-huh. You know, something that we don't do as distance runners. Now, I mean, it's hard to let off that brake, because everything we do is pace-based and I got to hold back and I got to pace myself. Well, you know, if you warm up with a 50-minute run and then you end it with 8 12-second hill sprints as fast as you can go, that's a fresh stimulus for most distance runners.
Right.
And I definitely recommend doing that, you know, after you've been running a while, because, I mean, we're stiff, we're tight, we're distance guys, and we drive and we work and we sit all day. We don't need to do that cold, but we just started adding in these little things. And then for his workouts, we started gearing them to one race. So instead of, hey, Peyton, I want to do the Christmas 5K on Saturday and I want to do the turkey trot and I want to do this, mm-hmm. I said, Frankie, I said, I want you to pick one race day for the fall and we're going to focus on that. And sure enough, he picked the Foot Locker 5K cross country championships at the end of that fall. Mm-hmm. And he went from very consistently running 1630 to 1640 to running 1539 and winning the Masters division.
Wow. That's so cool. Wow. You must have felt great. He must felt great.
Oh, it was fantastic. I ran the open race that day and finished maybe 10 seconds ahead of him. And I turned around and I said, oh my God, that's Frankie. And like, I was jumping up and down in the finish chute because he came across, lifted his arms up, and I thought he was going to cry. He just looked so elated at the end of that race.
Yeah. Oh, how wonderful. And that the potential for that kind of improvement at that age is still there.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, he had turned 40 in October, and this race was the Saturday after Thanksgiving. So it was his first race as a master.
So talk about the motivation part of it, because, you know, it's hard to train hard and stay motivated. And especially if you've reached a plateau and you're not really seeing something like Frankie saw, which, you know, that doesn't happen every day.
Right. I mean, motivation to me, it's something when I was a high school coach, you know, my kids would ask me, hey, Coach Wall, I didn't feel like running on Saturday morning. And then on Sunday, we went to church and I got carried away with some homework in the afternoon. I just was not motivated at all to run. And now, you know, coaching adults, it's pretty much the same thing. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's a little bit more tangible. It's, hey, my kid was running a high fever on Wednesday morning and I had this track workout planned. I couldn't get it done. So sometimes it's not even the motivation. Sometimes it's circumstantial. But just you know, kind of keeping it in the frame of motivation, I think you need to have very clear goals. Mm-hmm. If your goals are too scattered or you're training for too many different races at the same time as a competitive runner, then sometimes you lose track of what you want to accomplish in that 3 to 4 month period, because that's manageable. And another right. thing that I recommend is keep those training cycles where you're really going after it to a manageable 8 to 16 weeks. You know, for a shorter race, you can probably get away with an 8 week buildup. For a longer race, you might need 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. But as an adult runner who's been running a long time, you have this really good natural base. You know, whether that's 30 miles a week or 60 miles a week or 100 miles a week, whatever your base is, that's there. And as long as you can maintain, you know, on the low end of that for most of the year, you know, have 3 training cycles a year where you can say, okay, work is not as busy in the winter. If I find a warm race somewhere in Florida or Houston or something like that, and I have Christmas, I have some downtime at Christmas, I can put in some really good work towards this race and keep it more focused and more intentional. And don't just train for months on end, you know, with a 3 month base phase and then a 3 month speed phase. And, you know, then you get to your race and you're exhausted because so much has come up in your life. Right. I just think keeping it short and sweet for the most part will allow you to maximize what you're doing. And that way you don't have the immune system dips and you don't have time to really get hurt if you have that base. It's just when we're doing things for so long without a break, you know, that's when our mind starts to go and we start to lose that motivation as we get older.
I agree.
Yeah.
The motivation thing where you're talking about 2 or 3 major races a year makes a ton of sense in so many ways. Logistically, for your body to adapt to whatever it is, to stay motivated, as you said, trying to stay motivated race after race after race is just tough.
Sure. And I mean, I've seen that, you know, I mean, we think that like elite runners are completely impervious to that. It happens with the elite ranks too. I mean, look at, you know, I mean, to use a broad example, and Ryan Hall was a heck of an athlete, but I mean, somebody like Ryan Hall who had to perhaps prematurely retire because he just raced and raced and raced and raced. And there weren't really these defined periods of this is the training buildup. And then this was the rest period, you know, following that. And I mean, it happens, you know, to amateur athletes, recreational runners, competitive local runners, it happens to pretty much everybody. And I think we don't give ourselves enough credit that we're busy adults. We have type A personalities. We think if we're not doing something, we're not getting better, but really the magic's taking place in those 2 or 3 weeks, 4 weeks between your training seasons. And those don't have to be complete rest. They just need to be a period of time where, you know, instead of having that sandwich with the boring turkey for lunch, you might go out with your friends and have a burger. And, you know, instead of running 20 miles on Sunday, you might just go run 12 with somebody a little slower than you and actually enjoy it, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. taking those times just to regenerate a little bit and, you know, build back up. I mean, yeah. you know, I mean, sometimes it's physical, you know, I mean, we get to the end of a training cycle, we look like Skeletor and we need to, you know, to have that time afterward just to regroup physically. I mean, you know, if we look at outside of the sport of running, if we look at UFC fighters or boxers, I mean, their training buildups are extremely intense, but then they'll take a month off after that. You know, they'll get, you know, not be at fighting weight, right. not be up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I mean, that's part of that cycle. And I think our world beating African runners and even some of the Japanese runners today are doing that very well. They have that balance where this is on. I'm 100% in my running right now and then be able to just switch it off like a light on the wall.
Seems like really good advice. And also, I was thinking when you were saying this, that most of us want to run for the rest of our lives. And so there's time for these things. And truly, because I'm certainly an older runner at this point in my life, there are different goals that you have at different points in your life. But running, overall running, I think is something that all of us hold incredibly dear. So it can't all be totally totally hard. So, okay, running community. I know I brought that up in my introduction, and I want your opinion on how being part of a running community might help and some of the ways that people might get involved with other runners. Because you've coached teams, you've coached individuals, you've formed running clubs. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, I definitely have been fairly enterprising with wanting to get things started and seeing people come together on this sport that we love, that is an activity and it is a lifestyle. I mean, whether it's just a Thursday afternoon group that meets and goes run 5 miles and they have some beer afterward and play a round of trivia somewhere, or it's a serious competitive team like we see popping up, like Zap is a good example of that, and the community around that particular group. In Charlottesville, where I live, the Ragged Mountain Running Club is very, very much a community. It's a brotherhood. It's a sisterhood. It's something that is tangible and palpable, and that, you know, is really motivating for individual athletes. And running is such a lonely sport, you know, inherently, where those days that you're out there, you know, on your 10-mile training run by yourself, you know, if you do that every single day and you never have anybody to share that experience with, one, you're probably, it's going to affect your motivation over time. I mean, unless you're just one of those robotic, very steely people, which, you know, seems romantic and stuff, but really those people are often, you know, not the person that you necessarily want to hang out with or even ask to go run because, oh, they would rather do this by themselves. Mm-hmm. But it also, it opens you up to challenging yourself in strange ways when you have that community.
Indeed.
And, you know, I mean, that can be, okay, I've got this 18-mile long run. I know if I run with Josh and Joe, then they're going to push me this last half of this run, and maybe I need that. And then on the, you know, the downside of that, maybe the day or the other side of that, the next day, oh, well, if I go run with Sarah and Kate, they're always up, you know, for some really easy miles, and we always have a good time, and we laugh, and we cut up the whole way. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of balance that a community can give you. It's just different people for you to run with to achieve different things. And it sounds selfish, and maybe it is, but you're synergistically helping each other. You know, I mean, if I need an easy day, if everybody in the group, you know, is feeling good, maybe I run with one person, not 10 people. But then there's that rare day where everybody's clicking on the same day and, oh my gosh, we're running 20 seconds a mile faster than I would be by myself.
Right.
So, I mean, just from a training perspective, that's where the community would come in. And then some of the intangibles, it gives you somebody to share what we love with, you know, in a sense of community. And I mean, you know, going over to somebody's house for a cookout and things, or maybe, you know, you talk your spouse's ear off about running all the time. He or she gets fed up about it and it gives you that outlet too.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, if I go out with my guy friends or my girlfriends that I run with, I can talk about this all day long and nobody cares. You know, it also kind of saves our loved ones from that. I mean,
good point. No, that's a really good point. And having those parties after races, or having those get togethers every, you know, holidays and things with runners, it's so much fun. And everybody talks about running. Pretty crazy. Now, you've also coached cross country, right? And
did you coach
all levels of, or all seasons of running with the high school where you were working?
I did, except for indoor. We could only coach two seasons a year, so I took indoor off. Always used that time as kind of one of my key race periods during the year for myself. Mm-hmm. And then we started back up in late February for track season.
I've never actually coached track except for endurance runners. And that seems like a different level of guidelines, and also a different way of motivating people. You definitely have more of a community or a group spirit there, or at least a group to work with.
Sure. And I mean, you just have to, anytime you're in a position like that where you can influence a group, and in this case, it's extremely important because you are working with young people.
Yeah.
First and foremost, you just have to be a good role model. You know, I mean, your lifestyle and your habits and your behavior ultimately influences the group around you. And, you know, if that's not on point, or if it's negative, then the kids are negative. If it's positive and if it's upbeat and it's encouraging, then the kids are positive and encouraging to each other. So, I mean, it all starts and ends with the coach of a team, I think, in terms of building that rapport, building that sense of community within the team. And, you know, if you're a good coach, starting to build a little bit of a legacy that even when you leave, they're still, you know, hey, we're still doing Coach Sarah's workouts, and she retired from coaching 3 years ago, or whatever it might be. You know, that's the legacy that you want to kind of leave behind when you're coaching, because it means you made your mark not only on individual kids, but also on the program
itself. Yeah. So let's touch on four or five key types of training that are research supported to boost fitness, offer variety, and stimulate the body towards a positive adaptation.
Sure. This kind of, it fits in with my model of coaching within 2 week microcycles that are manageable. I don't think that the body really cares, you know, about a 7 day cycle. Just because we use a calendar that follows 7 days, it doesn't really follow the way that the body adapts. Mm-hmm. You know, there are periods of time, you know, be they hormonal or you're just getting into really good shape where you can handle slightly more training. And then there's periods of time where you need to back off and kind of respect your body. So typically what I will do with a 10 to 14 day training block is I'll have 8 to 10 days where we are in fact trying to overload the system a little bit. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that every day is hard, but we are, you know, we are still maybe adding a little bit of intensity to our runs. We're trying to get that aerobic run pace. And I shy away from easy runs in between workouts because mm-hmm. I definitely use a stair step model where to me, easy is like dog slow. Like that is jogging. It's purely for recovery and regeneration. And then we kind of have a moderate zone and a little bit more of an assertive zone that starts to back a little bit with our aerobic threshold and lactate threshold. So we're definitely moving those zones during the week so you don't get stuck in. All my easy days are at 8 minute pace, and then I'm asking myself to run 5 minute pace in these 400s the next day on the track. I just think the gap is too big from day to day. And in that 14 day cycle, I would place no more than 4 hard workouts. So that's 2 a week. If you're traveling 1 week, then you may be able to get away with like a Sunday, Wednesday, Saturday hard day on 1 week. And then you may only work out on Tuesday or Wednesday the next week. You know, you really need to stay on. Would not exceed 4 quality days in that 2 week period. I just think for injury prevention and for adaptation and for actually moving towards your goal, that is a good amount of work in that time. So that way you can run more total volume because you're not tired all the time. That volume can be a little bit more mechanically sound so that you're not spending so much time on the ground. You're not slogging through a run, you know, way slower than you need to. And that's all very individual. And I mean, at the same time, you're actually enjoying these workouts because they're not coming every other day. They're coming maybe every third or fourth day.
Yeah.
And within those, the 4 key workout types that I prescribe for everyone up until they get to that last maybe 8 weeks before a goal race. So this is going to be kind of an in-between time. You know, we take a little bit of a break after one season. This is maybe that first 6 to 8 weeks and before we get into a very specific phase for a 5K, a 10K, a marathon, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. But what I like to do is I like to have 1 hard long run where you are running either progressively or steady state somewhere around your goal marathon pace if you're under a 3:30 marathoner. So let's just say a typical 3-hour marathoner. This would maybe start off about 7:20 pace, mm-hmm. and it would get down to about 6:50 or 6:40, but no faster than that. You don't want to cross over your lactate threshold at that particular point. You don't want your heart rate to get too high. And work on extension with that particular run. Time spent at that high-end aerobic threshold, you know, if you couple that with some strides and drills and strength training, that to me is the key distance runner's fast, continuous run where you're just kind of grinding along. You know, it's not super hard. You're still able to speak in short sentences, but every week or every time you come back to that particular workout, maybe you add 10 to 15 minutes or 2 miles, but I wouldn't add any more than 2 miles to those. Right. And the way that we typically structure that could be progressive across the whole run where you could start off quite slow and then progress to your last mile over the course of a 14, 15, 18 mile one run, whatever it might be, or the way that I prefer to structure when you get a little bit closer to your racing season is to treat it like a warm up. Do your 2 or 3 mile warm up and then 10 to 12 miles kind of in that zone right around marathon pace. For most runners, if you're a little bit slower, this will be a little bit faster than marathon pace. And just hang on to that. You know, if it's, mm-hmm. if it's 50 minutes, great. If it's 60 minutes, great. I would not exceed 90 minutes just because you start to really tap into your glycogen stores. It becomes harder to recover for those. But I mean, to me, that is that backbone bread and butter workout that everything else kind of revolves around. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end of that particular spectrum, you know, working within those 4 workout types. And this is something that does require a little bit of work in terms of finding a place to do it. You could do this on the track. You could do it up a longer hill. You could do it on a big grass field, but it's called strength endurance circuit training. It's something that the Italian coaches, Portuguese coaches, Spanish coaches have used for a very long time. It's starting to trickle over a little bit into the United States. Steve Magnus has recently popularized these a little bit with some of his work, some of his podcasts and his books, but this is something that I got directly from Renato Canova. It's something that he definitely uses with his athletes in their early season and even into the late season if he thinks he needs it. But you need about 4 to 6 minutes of work per rep with these, and you're going to blend a mix of faster running drills and body weight exercises in a circuit fashion. Mm. And there's really no science to how you want to do it, but you know, you need, this needs to be something that is difficult on the body. Kind of give you an example. It'd be, if you could do it uphill, it would be 30 seconds uphill. And then maybe you would pause to do 10 body weight squats. And then you would run another 30 seconds uphill. And maybe you would pause to do 10 squat jumps where you squat down and then you kind of explode up ballistically, a little bit of a plyometric, another 30 seconds uphill. And then maybe you put in some high knees, some tail kicks, some bounding, do another set of body weight squats, maybe some push-ups, and then another 30 seconds uphill until you get into that 5 or 6 minute total work duration. And that's counting the exercises. And what that is designed to do is not only obviously strengthen your muscles and your cardiovascular system, but it creates a little bit of permeability in the membrane, in the cellular membrane, where lactate can start to enter the cell. You get a little more accustomed with that lactic acid burn, you know, that little bit of discomfort, but then your body has to force to kind of filter back out of the cell, which becomes very race specific. And this is something you get 3 or 4 minutes into each individual set, and you're like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done, especially if it's uphill. But then 3 or 4 minutes later, you feel like you haven't really done anything. So it's very, very, you have to be cautious with it if you're not familiar with certain exercises and things. But it is very, very effective, I think.
It sounds like it would be really effective. Now, we are actually getting close to being out of time, but we know, you know, we, most of us listening are adults, so training does not occur in a vacuum. So how can we modulate good training to fit our busy lives? And how can we synergistically link our training, our nutrition, and lifestyle habits to better our performance?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we've touched on that a little bit. And my biggest advice is, you know, put your first, put your work first. Kind of, you know, use that left side of your brain for most of your work and use the right side of the brain, the more creative aspect of your brain for your training. I know that kind of sounds counterintuitive because running is so mathematical and it's so scientific on some levels, but you need to look at it like a musician would look at his or her music mm-hmm. rather than this hard thing I have to do. You know, it's just like, it's like practicing, you know, for a band or something like that. This is my passion. This is my hobby. I want to do my best at it. And it requires some creativity to work that around. You know, when am I going to get this in? My best advice for that, somebody that is busy, you got to get up early. You know, that alarm has got to go off and you've got to get up and you need to get that out of the way before your day gets too busy. Right. You know, I mean, for people that have children and things, that can be a little bit tricky. But I mean, if worse comes to worse, you know, get a gym membership or get a treadmill in your house and go take care of your training first thing in the day. And if you have time in the afternoon, that's great. If you have time at lunch, that's great. But my biggest advice to busy adults is to wake up early, have that cup of coffee or tea, and get out the door. And once you start moving, it's not that bad. But I mean, sometimes 4:30 in the morning seems worse than it actually is. And just make that part of your routine on a regular basis so that you know that that's taken care of.
You feel so good after you've done something like that and you've got the rest of your day then to...
Sure, it's a little sense of accomplishment, and I work in sales. So, I mean, for me, you know, it's that little competitive nugget that I keep in my back pocket. You know, when I'm in a meeting or if I'm presenting, you know, something to a group of customers that I need to be on and I need to be sharp. To me, it gives you a major advantage in things that you do outside of running because, you know, I was in the gym this morning lifting weights at 5:15 and I had already run 8 miles at that point. And, you know, people come into meetings and they're sleepy and they're yawning and stuff, and you've been up and you are sharp and you are dressed at that particular point. It makes you feel really good, like you're kind of in control of your capacities and in uncomfortable situations a little bit easier.
Today's show is brought to you by Care of, a monthly subscription vitamin service that delivers completely personalized vitamin and supplement packs right to your door. And if living healthier has been a priority for you this year, Care of is the perfect way to build a vitamin routine that's made just for you and your health goals. I have 2 reasons to love Care of. 1, their personalization, and 2, their research-based recommendations. When you first start with Care Of, you'll fill out an innovative and fun quiz that takes your goals, history, and lifestyle into account. This quiz then provides you with a supplement recommendation pack. And what I really love is that every recommendation is linked to in-depth research reviews that help you evaluate the science yourself. As you know, we're all about the science at Runners Connect. You can add and subtract supplement recommendations as you see fit or based on what you want to try. Finally, your monthly supplements come in daily dose packs, so you don't have six bottles of random pills everywhere. It's more organized and makes sticking to your supplement schedule easy. They even have a super cool app that makes tracking your progress simple and fun. I'm loving the Care Of system for its ease of use and how the science-based supplements help me sleep and help my training. If you want to give Care Of a try, you can get 50% off when you use the code RTTT50 at takecareof.com. Again, that is 50% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins at takecareof.com with the promo code RTTT50. Welcome back with Peyton Hoyle. Are you revved up for the final kick, Peyton?
Let's do it.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, so what is a favorite local training run in your neighborhood? And tell us where to park, name a starting point, you know, enough information that the runners could actually find it and enjoy a run there, including remind us of your city again.
Sure. I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, and we have a plethora of really nice places to run. Right from my particular residence, though, in about a mile and a half of running, I can be on the Saunders Trail at Monticello. That's Jefferson's home site. It kind of meanders up. It's not single track. There are some single tracks off it, but it's this wonderful little limestone path with these big bridges that goes up for about 2 miles or so, and then you can meander back down or you can add on to the single tracks. But it's a really wonderful spot, especially in the fall when the leaves are changing, because it just meanders up the forest trail and then it comes back down and you get a beautiful mountain view at the top. So it makes a little bit of an incline worth it, but that's definitely where I would recommend just from my place.
Sounds like you could hike it as well as you could run it.
Oh, you could. I mean, people, especially in the spring, we had a little bit of a warm snap yesterday. I was out there yesterday afternoon. There were probably 100 people just walking with their dogs and stuff up and down the trail. So it's a fun place. It's safe to run. You know, I mean, there's a park ranger that comes around and there's tons of people out there. So yeah, you're never really by yourself on that particular trail.
Right. Well, sounds like a fun place to run. So how about a favorite running or running related book?
Definitely my favorite. I was an English major in college, so I probably would choose something a little bit more literary. But Life at These Speeds by Jeremy Jackson, to me, is whether you're a runner or not, it's a beautiful adult coming of age story. It's about a high school student who has experienced a pretty remarkable tragedy, where he loses a little bit of time, kind of puts it away, and he comes to realize when he's a sophomore in high school that he's actually a fantastic runner and how that kind of shapes his early adulthood. But it's a good read.
Wow, thank you. A humorous story.
Humorous story. Actually, my biggest hesitation with coming on to this particular podcast is how terrible I am with technology. My fiance, my coworkers and stuff, they make fun of me all the time. So I can't wait to tell them that I actually logged on to a podcast service and put on a headphone and conducted this decently today.
That's pretty humorous. Good for you.
Yeah, my boss jokes that I'm a relic from a different time because I have no sense with technology and computers.
Well, you definitely have an outstanding personality. So I guess that makes up for the loss.
Thank you, Steph.
The technology area. Okay, is there some one, a person or a subject about running that you believe our listeners might like to hear in a future podcast?
Yeah, somebody that I'm actually pretty fascinated with right now with his training and just kind of his personality in general is Tom Schwartz. I believe it's Brogan Austin's coach that you had on a little while ago. If you hadn't had him on the show, he'd be a great candidate, I think.
Yeah, I think he would be too. I've got to get in touch with him because, of course, I know how to get in touch with Brogan. And he recommended also that Tom Schwartz would be a great interview. So thanks for that.
Yeah, I mean, Tom, definitely more of a physiological interview than you would typically get. But I mean, I think that some of his talking points on critical velocity training and just knowing when to back off and knowing when to push are very relevant. It'd be great subject matter. I'd look forward to listening to that myself.
Good. Okay. Well, we are at the end of our interview. So be sure to follow us at the Runners Connect Winner Circle on Facebook by going to runnersconnect.net/FB. And please subscribe to Run to the Top podcast at runnersconnect.net or on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, etc. You'll be notified every week when the new episode is published. Thank you, Peyton. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, Stephanie. I appreciate it.
And wishing you much health and happiness in your life and in your upcoming wedding, which isn't very far away.
It is not. It's happening on Saturday. I appreciate you bringing that up.
And finally, thanks to all of you, our listeners, for joining us today. We'll be back next week with another great talk to entertain, educate, and inspire you as you head out on your running workout. This is Stephanie K. Atwood, your host with Run to the Top, and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.